extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Wow, oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, presented by AT&T 5G. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Matt Doyle, Kalen Carr, David Goss. It is a Monday. It is International Break Monday. We will be talking USMNT and Canadian Men's National Team. Despite the naysayers, despite the, one or two Twitter accounts that said, hey, stick to MLS. We are going there. We've always gone there. Don't try to control us. This, don't try to put us on a leash.
I think this is the Austin thing again, and I think I have figured it out. Pure full investigation. We're with Wiebe. One person, one time, will say something on social media. He will create a mob out of them and then wish it into reality.
Behold, in a my month, straw man army gathers. They
and in
assemble.
A month, it's going to be all the people who hate the national
light
team
the
conversations.
It's a World Cup year. Deal with it. Yeah, you're probably right. Got the straw man army in check, though, right now. We are going to, as always, talk about the national team. But we got some good stuff on MLS. Gago Slonina, Real Madrid. His agent wants it. Chicago Fire want more than Real Madrid want to give. I don't know. We'll talk through that one. We'll go through our best outside back duos in MLS. We will get hyped about Cruz Medina. Who's Cruz Medina, you ask? Well, David Goss is here to tell you, and Tati Castellanos might go to Leeds or he might not. I don't know what the hell is going to happen with Tati, but it seems like he is going to move. A reminder for all of you. First of all, every Canada, if they play, and we will talk to Peter Galindo of Sportsnet and MLS in just a bit about why they didn't play against Panama this weekend. If they play, and then the United States men's national team, when they play, we have watch-alongs on those YouTube Live as well as Twitch. The lineup is sick, honestly. Doyle, it was you and Susanna and DeMarcus Beasley and Charlie Davies the other day. We had Mehdi Bellucci on to talk about Morocco with us. We got a good lineup come up as well. We will promote those and let you know when they're happening and who will be on those. I also just want to say happy Nations League Final Victory Day to everyone who celebrates. And Christian Pulisic Shush Day, that is today. It's been a year since that victory against Mexico, and it's now just 168 days until the U.S. men's national team takes on Wales in Qatar. Wales.
Gales?
1-0 winners against Ukraine in that playoff. They got through, and 170 days until Canada takes on Belgium. So happy Nations League final day to all that celebrate.
Is Wales England? Does anyone know? I'm just asking for a friend.
We should ask the Welsh that.
Yeah.
They might have it.
If we call up someone in London, would they be able to answer that for us as a Welsh person? Does anyone know?
A lot of back and forth on that one historically. All right. You want to jump into it, guys? Let's do it. But first, congratulations to Toronto FC, who picked up a trophy this weekend. 2020 Canadian Championship champions. If they were to win another trophy this year, let's say the Canadian Championship from this year, or
ooh,
I don't know.
That's a good question.
Be a double? Would it count as a double? Is this double eligible? Random question just popped into my head that I know that Doyle hates. What do you think? Anders says yes. Nobody else cares. That's
care.
The state of the 2020 Canadian Championship. Disrespect. All right, let's get into the USMNT. 0-0 against Uruguay. I want to say before we do the soccer stuff, I commend the statement, really brave statement, I thought, from the players and staff on gun legislation that they made ahead of the match. And then they also wore orange armbands in support of the movement championed by Everytown for Gun Safety. So I thought that was pretty legit by all the players involved. Christian Pulisic came out afterwards and had some interesting things to say. I encourage you to go look that up. Much more important than what he had to say after Cincinnati, I might add, in that sense. Seven starters stay the same for Greg Berhalter, Joe Scally in, DeAndre Yedlin in, so they change the outside backs. Weston McKennie back from the broken foot, plays 45 minutes. And Sean John is the goalkeeper in this game. Mexico lost 3-0 to Uruguay, so by the transitive property, or I don't know, I'm not great at these things, but we're still the champions of CONCACAF. And the U.S. extended its unbeaten streak at home to 25 matches, one short of the program record set in 2015. Doyle, give me something positive, and maybe also then something negative, to take away from U.S.-Uruguay. Walk us through it.
I thought the first half was really good. It was played at a level of intensity and quality that was higher than I think you get in a typical friendly. And for the most part, I thought the U.S. looked really good. They had know, they had some issues compensating for Joe Scally, who was, I think, a little bit out of his depth in this one. But the other 10 guys, and I'm going to include Jesus Ferreira in that, they played good soccer. Now, the downside is with Jesus Ferreira is he's not finishing plays off. So, and this is, I think, going to be the big, you know, top line takeaway from this game for most people is that our number nines still are not scoring from open play. And with Jesus Ferreira in particular, it's getting to the point where it's like, okay, if you believe in center forwards who consistently find good chances, and you believe that guys like that will eventually figure out how to put the ball in the back of the net, then you're going to keep riding Jesus Ferreira, because like he had two in the first half against a very good Uruguay. It was like a B-plus Uruguay side. The flip side is some guys just aren't able to translate that up. Like for some guys, once you get to, you know, too high a level, it's just too high a level and there's no adjusting. I'm not enamored of Jesus Ferreira. I do prefer a more traditional striker. I would have liked to see Haji Wright get the start. I love guys like Brandon Vasquez and Jeremy Abobasi, who are more like sort of traditional number nines. But like, there's no denying that when Jesus Ferreira gets out there, he finds two or three looks a half where you're like, oh damn, he was right there. He had that, you know, he had a tap in, or he had a 1v1 with the keeper from 14 yards. That's good. And then it's like, he missed it. That's not as good. So I like, it's like, I mean, that's it, right? That's the story of the first. The second half was just a mess with all the subs. But the story of the first half was like, the U.S. played really good soccer and they didn't finish off their chances.
We will have a deeper conversation on the number nine, I think. Keep it rolling on positive negative, Kalen. What's something you liked that you saw?
Two clean sheets. That would stand out to me as the biggest of the takeaway. And I still think, although there were two clean sheets, I can't say there were a ton of outstanding questions answered in a positive sense, which is strange to say, except for Sean Johnson. I think he would be staying on the positive part. He was of this little window, the big winner from this, of the people that were a little bit, you know, trying to... Brendan Aaronson, yeah, he was really positive. Yunus Musa was really positive. But we kind of knew, especially Brendan and Yunus, we knew them. Or I think, like, a guy that was looking to kind of take his opportunity and really run with it. Sean stepped in against, you know, a really good national team, and we haven't gotten to see him. Oftentimes when we have seen him in the past, it's often been against competition that hasn't necessarily, you know, that's the reality of not being the number one in goals. And this was like a real opportunity for him, I think, to stake his claim as a person who we need to bring to the World Cup. And I think he did that, you know, making good saves. His distribution was very good. Constantly was able to find that nice little ball to Tyler Adams in under pressure, where we were able to continue to build out of the back. And he came up with that incredible save where he was able to get a foot on it and make himself big, hold his place when we needed it to hold a clean sheet against a top team. So a little bit lucky, I guess you could say, with the Cavani chance missed. I think Uruguay had some good opportunities. That's where it goes more towards saying there were still some issues in the back line overall. And I think, you know, to Doyle's point, there were a lot of changes made to the back line as the game went on. But even still, I thought that stood well for Sean Johnson. So I'll stay focused and say Sean was my big positive takeaway.
We will ask whether or not he has staked the claim to the number one here in a little bit. Dave, what's the what's like the headline for you here? What's the summation?
I think two positive ones jump out. One, as Doyle mentioned, just the ability to reach that intensity and competition level. To me, Uruguay they're in their own class of like just pure, if all 11 of us don't leave the stadium and we get 3 points, it was a good day. Like, that's what they're like as competitors, as a national team. And you saw, I thought, young American players step up to that moment and be able to react, especially in that midfield three, and be able to compete 50-50s, win chances. And then even out of that, then play the soccer they want to play and not just get locked into the intensity in the battle and getting there. And I thought Pulisic, so often when he plays anywhere inside, his first touch is negative. He goes back. He sort of assesses. He wants to see the whole field. It takes a while. I thought this was the best game I've ever seen him play, or at least in the recent past, where when he was inside, he was connecting. He was comfortable. He was linked with his team. There was variance to what he was doing. Those were the two things that jumped out to me on first watch that were positive on top of Sean John. And I thought that was really good. And then obviously you walk away, as Dull said, with the Jesus Ferreira conversations. And I just, I talked about it with Susanna on my show this morning. I just think some of these aren't going to end. We're waiting for someone to grab these spots. Goalkeeper, number nine. I think center back's a little different. It's at some point, it's just going to be, okay, what helps the team the most? Because there is no clear answer. And that's just the reality of a national team sometimes. And I think that's the reality of the age and exposure of our player pool to an extent at some of these positions.
Are we seriously talking about Sean Johnson as a number one?
Oh, no.
Because you, I don't you think did so. Say you,
well,
you,
I,
you well, know, Greg say, said it.
It's called. It's
but
called.
Greg has said it.
Did Greg say it? I didn't see Greg say that.
Greg said last week. Taylor said last week that Greg said in their meeting that when it comes down to it, I will play someone who has the hot hand and who is playing well. And if it's Sean,
specifically at goalkeeper.
Yeah. Yes. This was okay. This was the conversation was only about goalkeeper.
Yes, and it's still second hand.
And Taylor. Yes. And Taylor then said. Greg said unprompted. And if it's Sean, I'm happy if it's Sean. So my understanding coming out of that was he is happy to play all four of them, whoever it is that is better and whoever it is that gives them the best chance to win at the time. I think that there's a lot of coach speak in that. I think there's a lot of motivation and overall culture stuff that when you push comes to shove, it's going to be Zach Steffen. And he's going to say, well, he plays at Man City. He trains at a high level. He's giving us our best chance today. But he worded it in a way that was, this is still a spot for Sean Johnson to win if he's the one who wins
it. I also recall Taylor saying during the broadcast of the Morocco game that he thinks that Matt Turner's won the number one job. Right? And, like, based upon form, it can't be Zach Steffen. It can't. Zach Steffen, he's not strung together two good games since 2019, man. I think Zach Steffen played his way out of the shirt, and given how good Matt Turner has been over the past 4.5 years for his club, and given how good he's been for the U.S. national team, including against Morocco the other day, given that he's now going to go to a team in Arsenal that always likes to build from the back, and he's going to get the same types of minutes that Zach Steffen has been getting for the past 2 years, which is to say not starters minutes, but every now and again he'll play. I would be surprised if it was not Matt Turner as the starting goalkeeper.
But it's June 6th. Has Matt Turner played well in 4 months?
I mean, he played awesome against Morocco. Both stopping shots and, saving the ball.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not going to say the three games that he's played with the Revs as he's shaking the rust off outweigh the previous 4 years. And as for Sean, he's been one of the best goalkeepers in the league this year. If it wasn't for Dane St. Clair, I think he would be, the leading contender for goalkeeper of the year at the midway point. He's been fantastic. I thought he was absolutely fantastic yesterday as well. Man of the match. I don't think that, based upon how Greg has viewed the goalkeeper position over the past few years, I don't think Sean has a chance to win the number one shirt.
I'll take the argument on the other side. I'll say, I think Greg has shown that Steffen is his number one. In the big matches, I think he's mostly played Steffen, regardless of form, even at times, when there is a chance. And then for me, what happened when Sean made that save yesterday, and this is what I was talking about as far as his getting the opportunity, I think the players on the team will have said they've trusted Sean in a big match before, but he hasn't necessarily had the opportunity based on that's the way it goes when you're on the outside and there's two guys ahead of you that you're not going to get those first team minutes against top competition. When he made that save, I texted somebody where I was like, I think we just saw Sean Johnson make the World Cup team. And I think part of the reason is because I think even if you rotate maybe against Granada, someone else gets, maybe Horvath gets the start. Based on the competition, like so much of making the team here is going to be about how you do against the competition, where it's like, I heard you guys talking about it on the post-game show or the watch-along stream, where it's like, if a striker comes in and scores three goals against Granada, are you going to feel like that they're automatically the number one? And I think everybody was like, no. And I think the same thing goes for goalkeeper, where, so I think Sean has, you know, taken a huge step towards making the team. And then I just think there's so many variables between form where if Stefan and Turner are slipping up and Sean and not doing well in Europe and Sean's able to continue this form, that's where I could see it starting to, this conversation starting to creep and grow. But I think he took a huge step towards cementing that third spot on the team.
If you have three goalkeepers and Horvath, you know, Forrester headed to the Premier League, if you have three goalkeepers and none of them are playing on your World Cup roster, that to me would be troubling.
No, I think
that's troubling. And that's where I go to where what you're saying, Kaelin, in the sense of like Sean John to me is a little bit like Christian Roldan in the sense that even if he's not going to get that chance to play, and he probably won't, him being the third goalkeeper is an asset in a lot of other different ways as well. Plus, you know that he could. Like, what if Stefan gets injured? I guess it is a family issue that has kept him out of this camp. I thought it was an injury, but I read Stephen Goff saying it's a family issue. Like, you know, Turner's had some injuries lately. Like, you want to have a dude that's been between the posts in competitive play with some regularity just as an option. And I thought one of the biggest moments of the match for me with him was he's under a little pressure, and the one where he, you know, Long puts it on his wrong foot and they have a disagreement, he kicks it out for a corner. Not his best moment. But he had another moment where he plays that outlet ball in stride to DeAndre Yedlin on the right side. That's an opportunity that Yedlin just misses because his touch is bad in the moment. He takes his eye off the ball. But like those little things weren't always things that we saw from Sean John 4 years ago, 3 years ago. And being in this NYCFC system, I think he's taken steps forward on that aspect of his game. So all of a sudden you have a guy who is a leader, who is a shot stopper, who's playing at a crazy high level in MLS, who's playing to me and is a veteran and is sort of a steadying presence. To me, he's like the perfect third goalkeeper for this particular iteration of where the U.S. is at in the goalkeeper position.
And the difference between Roldan is Roldan's in behind guys that are all starting it for their clubs across, you know, across Europe. And that's where he's almost further away, whereas Sean is potentially behind two guys that, at least as of right now, look like they are not going to be starting for their clubs. So he's got I think it's not an easy path because I think the other two are both preferred. But I think he would then carry that sort of leverage that we saw Turner holding for a while, where it's like, I'm playing regular minutes now. He made the choice to say, well, it didn't really seem to matter. I was going to still be behind Stefan, so might as well take my chance abroad anyways. But I just wonder if I felt like Sean made a big case to make that World Cup team yesterday. And if you're on that team with two guys in front of you that aren't playing, that's where the question starts to be posed.
We're going to do, and maybe we should just do it in this way. We had a question here that we're going to do at the end. Who are the locked-in starters for the U.S. right now? We're going to kind of go line by line. And maybe that's a better way to run through this conversation about Uruguay and overall the state of the national team. So we did it. We did the goalkeeper. I don't think any of us believe that there's a locked-in starter at goalkeeper. I think logic would tell you, appearances would tell you.
Well, it sounds like Doyle thinks Matt Turner is locked in.
I think he's close. I don't think he's locked in.
Okay.
If Stefan leaves and goes to, you know,
Eintracht Frankfurt,
championship club, or yeah, Eintracht Frankfurt, yeah, and he plays and he plays well, then it's probably back to him. But I think based upon how poor Stefan was during qualifying and how consistently he's made massive errors, even when he's gotten onto the field for Man City, I think he played his way out of the number one keeper spot. And it sounds like Taylor feels that way as well. And, you know, Taylor usually has good information, can base his hunch on that. But it's more, it's you know, I don't know. I just, it feels like Turner has checked every box. It really does. So I think it's really close.
if you had to, and like I said, we're going through sort of like who would be locked in starters against Wales, you would think on November 21st, but goalkeeper, you would just say for the three games. If you had to make a bet right now.
Turner.
Dave?
The starter against Wales?
Yep.
Zach Steffen.
Yeah, I'll take Steffen. Steffen.
I think I would take Steffen too if I was betting on it. If I had a preference, I would take Matt Turner. We'll see, man. We'll see. That's what the next however many months are about here. You know, 168 days is figuring out answers to these questions. I know Greg Berhalter and his staff are thinking hard. There's no doubt about it. They're not leaving rocks unturned here.
There's another American out there that's a dual national that I think they should consider. His name's Wayne Hennessy. They should put the real energy on to see if they can pull him in. I am all in on being...
Is Henny dual?
Yeah, I think so. I'll look it up. I'm all in on being anti-Wales and having Welsh people just be in my face about this. I want to start the greatest soccer rivalry ever, USA versus Wales.
Let's go. Let's go. All right, let's just because we're doing it this way, line by line, let's go on the back line. Who are locked in starters right now on the back line? To me, Zimmerman has made it abundantly clear that he is the first choice center back, and then everybody else is sort of competing to play next to him to compliment him.
I think I made this up. I don't think he's American.
Come on, we were so close to having like a Sun headline, like
Wayne Hennessy.
Wayne Hennessy's allegiance is divided ahead of U.S. Wales Super Copa or whatever the hell you would
sorry.
Call it. Good try. Good try. So what have we thought of Zimmerman so far? Just to start with that, because we all agree he's a lock right now, right? Like, game tomorrow in the World Cup, unquestionably.
He has done nothing to suggest that he's not the best center back in the pool. Like, I guess the misplay on Weah's throw-in, that was a little bit weird. Got bailed out a little bit there. I thought Long did well to scramble, but... no, Zimmerman has been, I think, the best field player for the U.S. over the last two games. And then I think a healthy Sergiño Dest and a healthy Anthony Robinson are both locks as well. And it's weird because Dest is the better player, the better overall player, but Anthony is more of a solid lock because there are so many big questions about who could be the backup left back. Whereas, like, if Dest gets hurt and can't go, whatever, like, I'm pretty confident in Reggie Cannon, and I'm pretty confident in DeAndre Yedlin, even Shaq Moore, if we have to go that far down the list. So, but, like, I think three of the four back line, those guys are locks. And then it's a question between Chris Richards and Aaron Long for who's going to partner Zimmerman.
Charlie made the suggestion. I think I agree with him that Dest is the backup left back.
So, okay, let me – sorry, because we've had this conversation a lot. One of the issues with that comment, and I understand what he means, Sergiño Dest is the best left back on the roster that is not Anthony Robinson or Jedi, whatever you want to call him. But if your concept going into the World Cup is that Dest is your backup left back, let's just word it like this. When you are rotating your team – Sergiño Dest is still playing. So if he becomes your backup left back, I guess you're probably going to play your best team against England. So you're not rotating from game one to game two. Now you go into game three. If Dest is your backup left back and he has started the first two games at right back and you're giving Anthony Robinson a break, Sergiño Dest is now playing 90 minutes at left back. So while I understand that concept and we've all said it, and I think Dest is as comfortable on the left as he is on the right, and as effective a player, fine. But he can play for Barcelona at left back sometimes, then you're good enough to play for the U.S.
No, I mean, yes, but no, it's different, David, because when he plays left back for Barcelona, he pinches inside, he becomes a midfielder. And the U.S. doesn't really play like that. Like, we played like that for three games at the start of Berhalter's tenure. We do not play like that anymore. So
okay,
even though
fine.
Sergiño Dest can play left back at a really high level, it changes so much about the way the U.S. play. And Barcelona can deal with that because they have some of the very best players in the world. We don't have that.
Well, actually,
I genuinely think we need a like-for-like replacement for Anthony Robinson.
Do you think this is a 26-man versus 23-man roster conversation? Because in a 26-man roster, it's not a question. In a 23-man, it could become a question given the depth in central midfield and on the wing.
No, because I think whether it's 26 or 23, you need that guy who's a like for like. And for a while, we thought it was going to be Sam Vines, and he kind of came up short. And then we were hoping it was going to be George Bello, and he came up short. And like Joe Scally has not made a good impression in two games and really was not good for Mönchengladbach after about mid-November. I have a lot of Kevin Paredes stock. I'm hoping that he comes out for Wolfsburg and is able to win regular minutes right away, because I think he is the closest thing to a like for like with Anthony Robinson. And from everything I heard, he was awesome back in December at that camp. He just got hurt and wasn't able to play in that friendly. But to David's bigger point is that like you can't say, oh yeah, we're going to rotate the team and keep everyone fresh. And part of rotation is, yeah, our number two left back is also our number one right back. Like it doesn't work that way.
I'm with you on bringing back like a like for like, but I don't think Jedi is going to be rotated. They even in qualifying, they seem to just continue to run him out. And then in this, I mean, this one, he just came off an illness. He didn't even train the day before the match, and they started him. So
he didn't start.
He didn't start this.
No, he came off the
bench. Scally started at left back.
This is like joke Scally erasure.
Yeah, right? Joe Scally started at left back.
what happens if he pulls a hamstring or gets COVID?
People don't get sick in this modern world here.
Doyle, though, back to one of your points. Yeah, nice. Back to one of your points. You can't download it there. Sam Vines came up short. He, since his last cap, has played 24 times in Belgium and has become the full-time starter. That's the one that I don't agree with, just because, same as what we saw from Scally, which was the same as what we saw from Jedi, their first international appearance, yeah, they're not great. But he has... It feels, the hope would be, and to be fair, I don't watch every Anderlecht game or Circle Bruges or Club Bruges. Which one am I on? Yeah.
Cirque.
Okay. But he started 21 times in Belgium this year. He's developed another year. He's changed the system that he's playing in, the style. That was the one name that I wanted to see on this roster that I was a little surprised didn't get a chance.
I'm with you.
I would guess he will be on the September roster because it'll probably just be only European-based players for the most part, with what's going on in MLS at that time and the fact that the camp will be there. But he feels the most liked for like from Jedi in the way his physical build, the way he plays the game, what he does. And while he may not win you games, it feels like he has the highest floor of the players you're talking about at that position. And I'm surprised he didn't get the chance in this window. And I don't think it's fair to say coming just out of last year's Gold Cup that he's lost the spot. But that's also how Greg Berhalter sees it. I'm not blaming Doyle on that. I'm saying I think that's the wrong way to assess that.
I think I agree with you. The one thing I'll add, I'll add two things. One, it's Royal Antwerp. And the other is like we've already gotten really far afield from like who's a locked in starter. Yeah, I think we can agree three of the four on the back line: Zimmerman in central defense, Dest, and Anthony Robinson. Then it's a question of who's the partner for Zimmerman. I think it's going to end up being Chris Richards.
Why?
Because even when Miles Robinson was healthy, Chris Richards was starting a lot of games. I think from October to the Canada game when Richards got hurt, I think he started like 4 out of 6 games. And like that's one thing. So we already know he's played in the pressure cooker of qualifying, and Berhalter clearly rates him. He also has reps playing with Walker Zimmerman, which matters. And on top of that, I just think he's the all-around most talented guy in the center back pool. Like he's not quite as dominant in the air as long as I don't know if he's quite as quick, but it's really, really close on that one. He's also a much better passer, and I think he reads the game really well. So I think that he, if he gets healthy and can stay healthy and he gets minutes, I think he is the most likely one to be starting alongside Zimmerman in that back line.
Any thoughts on what Long showed in these games, and in particular Uruguay? Any demerits? Any big positives? I think Doyle is right. Like, just as far as aerial dominance, he's very, very good in that sense. I think he's good as a recovering defender as well.
I don't think he scrambled well, Weeby.
I'm saying as a general player, I think that
you're
is
talking.
One of his strengths.
You're talking about Uruguay only, or you're also talking about Morocco?
About Morocco, I think he was a little bit. His scrambling around the box, it was effective, but it wasn't. He still looked a little bit rusty. He used to be really, really good at it, so I'm still attributing it to having missed a year of soccer and still maybe working his way towards it. But he's much better than Eric Palmer Brown, and he's much better than Cameron Carter-Vickers. So it's like he's clearly the third guy on that depth chart after Zimmerman and Richards.
I'll just say that the motorcycle revving in the background of someone's audio, but I take that to be very much like the heater from back in the day. When it clangs, when you hear a motorcycle revving, when you hear a siren, you know that there's legitimacy to said take. All right, let's keep moving up the lines here. Any thoughts on Joe Scally, actually, before we keep it rolling? Because he's been sort of a darling of the, hey, call him in, Greg. What the hell, Greg? Come on, Greg. Brigade out there. And I'm not, by no means is anybody going to throw Joe Scally out, but this was a big opportunity for him that was, let's say it was a learning moment for Joe. Any big thoughts there?
No.
I would just say he struggled because there were times early in the match where Berhalter was trying to get them to press and push forward. And it looked like they were really trying to jump up on top of them. But then the problem was at times Christian was having to track back too far. And I think it sort of it showed what I see from Jedi, which is really he does both. He's able to get up and back with that sort of volume of intensity to kind of like cover that much ground, whereas Scally looked at times to turn and run and catch up with guys was difficult, and then we weren't able to kind of like win the ball whenever we pressed, so they kind of shifted at a certain point and seemed to hold him back more, which I think things got better, but even still he just looked a little bit off it. He looked a little bit like he wasn't quite up to the pace and just a step slow here and there to find his footing. So I understand he normally plays on the right side. Is that right?
No, so, he played more on the left side this year than he played on the right. But he played primarily as a wing back, you know, in a five. So okay. It was different. And he lost his job by mid-November. He was kind of a bit player from then on. And there, you know, the coach at the time was very upfront about him having like kind of lost his form a little bit and was still trying to find his way, and that's what he looked like in this one, right? A kid, you know, kind of thrown into the deep end and just sort of hanging on for dear life.
To close midfield. It out, I would probably go with Bello as my, if you're going like for like left back, that'd be my pick, but just want to put that on the record.
Put it on the, get in the mailbag. Who do you want? Midfield. MMA has sort of been the accepted best midfield for the U.S., and I hear some chatter around different publications, podcasts, and pundits, the three P's, saying that maybe that wouldn't be the best for the U.S. in the World Cup. We saw Weston McKennie again for the first time since his injury, his foot injury. He was back for 45 minutes. Understandable that he wouldn't be necessarily at his very, very sharpest at this point, but you got to get those guys reps every opportunity that you can. Dave, let me ask you this. Is there a question about MMA at this point? With Aronson, you know, sort of excelling at the eight, with Reyna, you know, playing with a ball somewhere in Austin, and we assume getting back for Dortmund soon, has there become a question mark in midfield for the U.S. that seemed to be sort of accepted gospel very recently?
So I would spin the question a little and say, no, the question is not, can it not work? It's more there's other talent that could deserve to be in those spots and can play, which I think that's what shifted in my mind. We're coming out of qualifying. We had seen Brendan Aaronson inside. He hadn't played well there, so that kind of had gone away. Gio Reyna obviously is hurt, hadn't played in a while. And it felt like those three had completely elevated themselves in that they were good enough to win in that space together and they could play well together. Where now you have Aronson, I think, play successfully for two games inside. Will obviously now head to the Premier League, where if he's playing in that position week in and week out, that puts pressure on those guys, especially if Musa's not playing that position, if Tyler's not starting, not that Brendan Aronson's putting pressure on Tyler, and then Weston McKennie, obviously, we've seen be hurt at times, moved around in the past at Juve, and now he's settled in more centrally. So that's where the pressure would come from. And the big thing, I think, that I felt coming out of Morocco and feel less coming out of this game just because of the performance that he had is Musa won't be goal dangerous, and he isn't. And if your nine's not and he's not, you're starting to check up players off the field that aren't going to score goals for you at a time when you need it. Aronson can be that player and will be, and he will create chances and he'll finish them himself. And that brings a different element. And then Gio Reyna's another conversation. I don't even know if we want to have it just because we don't even know if he'll be on the field at any point. But so you have that, and then you have also shifted the formation a bit in the way that they play, which allows you other elements of players that you can bring in there. It also allows flexibility based on the opponents, which we hadn't really seen through the second half of qualifying. Now going into the World Cup, which brings other people into that conversation, especially I think Brendan Aronson as like the lone 10 in front of a Musa and Adams or a Kellen Acosta and Adams or whoever that is behind them. So I wouldn't say the question mark comes from the lack of quality. I'd say it more comes from other options that have now established themselves that could potentially play in there.
All right, shape time, Duel. I know that this is one of the things you took away from these two games the most in midfield and overall in the team. So take us through why the shape of the midfield matters, how it's evolving or changing, and what it could look like as we push toward Qatar.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what it's going to look like, but this was definitely an experiment, these two games. For most of qualifying, it was a single pivot with two free eights, or you know, however you want to put it, in front of them. So it was like a 1-2. In these two games, it was more of a 2-1, with Musa dropping deep next to Tyler Adams, and then Aronson, and yesterday McKennie, in kind of a 10 role. And obviously the shape changes throughout the game and throughout the phases. So, it, you know, at times it becomes a 3-2-2-3 or 3-2-3-2. And yesterday at times it was even like a 4-2-2-2. So it was a little like it was constantly, you know, adjusting. But the one thing that stayed solid was that Musa was playing deep. Musa was playing next to Tyler Adams. And that is not something that we saw a lot of, any of, that I could really remember in qualifying. And I think part of it was a nod to what Musa does so well, which is progress the ball. Whether it's with his passing or his ball carrying, we saw it a number of times against Uruguay, especially in the first half, where, I mean, I think it was 90 seconds in, he gets on the ball at the top of the 18 and he does a guy and just carries it 40 yards upfield. And like, suddenly the U.S. are in a much better spot. And having a guy like that in central midfield, to me, is a non-negotiable. Yunus Musa starts. He is in pen for me in Qatar as long as he's healthy. The reason for the shift, I'm not sure of. I think maybe part of it had to do with the fact that I think over the course of qualifying, Tyler Adams' limitations as a ball progressor were kind of exposed. And I think we saw that especially in the final round of qualifiers. Greg decided that the U.S. was not going to be a possession team. Like they were a pressing and counterattacking team and a primarily transition team against Mexico and even against Panama, and then, you know, tried to do it against Costa Rica. Costa Rica were too disciplined for it in that game. But I think a lot of it was sort of came from that loss to Canada in January, where Canada, I think, time and again dared Tyler to hit meaningful passes to get the U.S. into spots where they could attack, and Tyler really wasn't up for it on that day. So I think maybe flipping the shape of the midfield triangle and getting Musa deep next to Tyler And it should be noted, Luca Della Torre, who I think is Moose's primary backup, when he come in the past two games, he's been playing deep as well. I think the idea is to help, to give Tyler help with ball progression in the toughest spots on the field. The knock-on effect of that is that it releases Tyler upfield to press. If he's not just sitting and protecting the back line, then you can weaponize his ability to force turnovers in good spots. And I think they've been trying to do that. It wasn't great. It wasn't great in either game. I think if you go back and you look at the big chances, especially that Morocco created, a lot of it came with Tyler way upfield. In this one against Uruguay, I think the first two chances came with Tyler way over out towards the sideline, trying to get pressure to a ball, having a guy pinned and not being able to keep him pinned. And then they were able to turn and cut out the entire midfield. So it's all a work in progress. But whether it's the 2-1 or the 1-2 with Tyler just holding and protecting, I think Musa, McKennie, Adams, they're the starters. I don't care how well Brendan Aaronson's playing. I don't care, you know, if Gio Reyna is back. I want those three guys as the starting midfield, period.
So, yeah, I can understand that. If Brendan Aaronson is playing well in the Premier League, he's going to get a chance at that spot. There is an argument. So there's an argument that the spot he's fighting for could be with Weston McKennie and not with Yunus Musa.
I think it is with McKennie. I don't think that. I personally don't think that's a question.
So I don't know that if Weston McKennie is healthy, that he comes off the field culturally for this U.S. team. He has
culturally
established himself.
Set pieces, man.
Yeah.
Even yesterday, he got on the end of two set pieces.
Agreed. So I think he's established himself as a starter for this team and the leader of this team. Walker's in there as well. Tyler's in there as well. Pulisic. But I think Weston McKennie is the guy, and especially in the Mexico games that they had and some of the bigger moments the second half of qualifying after he got back with the U.S. Like, he, I think he's locked in for all those reasons. The other thing I found interesting, not just Moose's ability to progress the ball, is it changed the shape that the U.S. was playing against, and they were able to play through the middle better. And you didn't see that a lot in qualifying because those two eights sat so high at times, there wasn't space for them to play. And I think it opened the game up a little bit. Now, I think a portion of that is no Valverde, no Torreira. This was a different midfield for Uruguay than what they played on Thursday night. And it was players that weren't as familiar with each other, and I don't think were as comfortable in what their jobs were. And so they got exposed, they got opened up, they chased a little bit more. But that ability to play through the middle, I don't think we've seen that from the U.S. like at any point in qualifying. So that was really entertaining and interesting. I was right then, right? If I say
that's like a world-class fact check right there.
I would say the last thing on Tyler is it feels like that ball progression, his passing, it has regressed as he has played less at Leipzig. Over the last year and a half, I think we've seen him less confident. He doesn't hit the ball as clean. He doesn't take as many risks. And I don't know if that's him trying to fit into the U.S. style of play, which is obviously different than the Red Bull style, or if it's just that he's not playing, and so he's playing worse than he was.
I thought he hit two good balls against Morocco that had openings that were helped, that were created in large part by either Musa with his movement flaring out on one of them, or Musa being an option and a player that other teams have to sort of key on to give Tyler room in the midfield to turn and have passing lanes. When I say that I think the competition is with Weston, I sort of think that there's not a competition. I thought the Morocco game was a run out for Aaronson of like, what if we don't have Weston?
Right.
Injuries, suspensions, whatever it is. I thought that was an experiment to give them time together ahead of what is a possibility, a scenario in the World Cup that, you know, especially if you get the knockout rounds, it's very possible that they'll have to deal with, even if they don't, knock on wood.
You guys, there is a very real possibility that Leeds is a top 10 team in the Premier League. And there's a very real possibility that Brendan Aaronson is a central attacking part of that. And I get what all of you are saying, but there's no way that it doesn't become a conversation when he gets, if that's what happens. Now, there's also a chance that Brendan Aaronson has played 112 minutes going into the World Cup because he's going to a new league. the Austrian league is nowhere near where it needs to be. But based off the performance against Bayern, Jesse Marsh's connection to him, all of that,
wow,
the other one's a pretty high possibility.
Bigger stray right here, the Austrian league or Darlington Nagby from Hurt Gomez.
If you get a chance to take one at the Austrian league, you gotta swing full through. Yeah.
Just here's a quote from Greg on Yunus Musa. Quote, Yunus is a guy that just blows me away at his age with what he can do. Crazy level of talent. We need to work with Yunus on this final, the final product, the final pass, the finishing, because he has a huge ceiling. Kaylin, any final thoughts on the midfield? We'll push it to the number nine and keep it rolling.
No, I would say MMA, lock it in for me. I love Brendan Aaronson. I think he did a great job. I agree with you as far as finding a place for him on the pitch, but I still think he's better on the wing. I think he's better just applying pressure, getting closer to goal, combining. I like him there. So why don't they just
play with six wingers? Just play 12 wingers. Go Uruguayan style and just play as many players as you want.
So,
by the way, are we gonna ding Brendan for keeping everything on side on that spectacular save Sean made yesterday? That was 100% on Brendan Aaronson. Like, he tracked back, slide tackle, tried to block the cross, couldn't, and then just like got up and slowly jogged back upfield, keeping the whole thing on side and like not even bothering to mark his man. It was pretty rough.
Seems like we did ding him. Got it in, baby. Got it in. All right, just quickly on the winger line here. Pulisic, starter, period, in the team. Is Weah a lock or not?
No. I mean, he's played awesome, but I think he's competing with Brendan Aaronson and Gio Reyna. And I think if all three of those guys are healthy, I think it's Gio Reyna who will be the starter of the three.
Not a lock, but not based on his performance, or just the talent that we have available there. So, yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. All right. I think we can move up to the forward line.
Should Pulisic be a lock?
If Timothy Weah is not starting for the U.S., I'm not even showing up. And I wasn't even invited to show up, so that's how strongly I feel about this.
Okay.
You guys are out of your minds.
Yes, right. Pulisic is a lock, just to answer the question.
Yes, for sure.
I thought we were just going to ignore that.
We came back to it.
I'm gonna bring Bobby on for a show to get
well.
I would.
Well,
oh my
interesting.
God. If you think that's not a threat, that's like I welcome
you.
I
also
welcome that.
Remember
I
this
wish in my dreams.
This show started a conversation about a lack of depth at left back. So you can combine both issues: Christian Pulisic, backup left back, and now Bobby hosts the show.
Whoa! Everybody, get on board here. How about the number nine? I mean, we've summed it up a bit here. Taji Wright, it's Jesus Ferreira. To me, it's Jesus and then a question mark behind him. Not necessarily behind, but in competition with him. I think Ferreira will be at the World Cup. He has shown, to my eye, more of an ability with this group of players to get into good goal-scoring positions and to also help set them up to get themselves into those positions than anybody else in the pool. By the way, since the start of qualifying, Sam Stach will just put this stat out. 4 open play goals for U.S. strikers in 17 games. So it's not just Jesus that's not exactly gold. I'm not going to say not goal dangerous, but not goal scoring. Let's just put it that way.
I'll hop in here and say the other argument that I've heard for Jesus, which if you're looking at these last two games is troubling, is that his presence opens up the attack for others and that he's like more of a facilitator that's going to bring goals. So it's like, he's not just to be judged by his finishing, which is, has been great in MLS, but we haven't seen it with the national team as of late. But that it was going to continue to open up opportunities for Christian or Weah or, you know, other players coming in. And I guess you could say on the Christian goal in behind, he sort of vacates that spot. It's sort of there. We've seen that run a couple times from Walker where he plays it over the top and finds Christian kind of streaking in behind. And you could say maybe playing with somebody like who's more of that false nine opens up more of that space often. But in this last game, it didn't seem to really happen the same way. And then ultimately it's disappointing because I feel like if he were just to grab one of these two chances, right. Or finish one of these in, it's like, it's right there for him. And I just like, I don't know Jesus. I don't know his personality or not, but you're kind of like missing that nine just to be like, give me that chance to do it. I think we saw a little bit of that attitude from Pepe when he was playing, who I'm still kind of holding out hope is able to kind of find his form and get back into it. But yeah, that part to me is, and then the last part is just really the change of the prototype of like who's going to be playing. And I think we need different options in the nine. So you have some players that can play like the false nine, but you also need somebody that can occupy a little bit more space or challenge or get in behind, be a little bit more threatening, be more of like a physical presence, I would say.
Is there a new face that should come in, or like what's the group competing for this spot? It's Pepe, it's Ferreira, it's, you would assume now, Haji. Who else is in that?
Zardes, still.
I don't think so.
No way.
Yeah.
You think Giassi Zardes is out of the conversation?
I do.
They came into a camp. Jesus Ferreira scored 0 goals. Pepe doesn't play right now. And Haji Wright didn't get the chance to start, which I think shows a bit of where Greg has him. And you think Giassi Zardes is out?
I think right now, I'm with Doyle. If Giassi went on a freaking tear with Colorado the rest of the year and everybody else stayed sort of like status quo the same, okay.
I mean, status quo is for Ferreira is literally like leading the Golden Boot race.
Well, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. I think it's Ferreira, and then it's Ferreira and somebody else. Well, Ferreira's going to the World Cup.
Unfortunately, for Jesus, yesterday was probably his last chance to change. That was the one competition at that high level for him to say, I can do it at this level. Everything he scores in MLS is going to be great.
I don't agree with you that the MLS players aren't going to be brought to the September friendlies.
Okay, but again, is it against Saudi Arabia and South Korea? That's still not Uruguay.
No, right? But like those are World Cup teams, though.
Yeah, well, but are Wales and Iran Uruguay? No.
So Wales and Iran are both better than the two teams I just named, right? Iran was the best team in Asian World Cup qualifying. They're better than every other team the U.S. will play, right? So from a level conversation, yeah, they're better.
Anyway, Daryl DK could get hot and work his way into it. Pepe could come back out, start starting for and scoring for Augsburg and come back into it. If Jeremy Abobasi and Brandon Vasquez each score, you know, 20 goals, maybe they work their way into it. Haji Wright's not done. I think he'll probably start against Granada. You know, he can't win the job with a hat trick, but if he starts burying cupcakes and gets his confidence up, he fits. I'm with Kalen, man. He fits the sort of the need to have a different look in the center forward pool. Like it's like the opposite of what we were talking about with left back. Like I want a like for like. I want someone who can do what Anthony Robinson does, where you stretch the field and you don't have to change the way the U.S. plays. With my center forward core, I want guys who play the position differently so that we can change the game just by putting him on there. So like Haji, Daryl DK, Pepe to a lesser extent, Brandon Vasquez, Jeremy Abobasi, they all
say Jordan
fit
Peacock.
That mold. I think Jordy Peacock's done. I think Jordy Peacock got his looks and wasn't able to do anything with it. But like in general, it's still like the most, I think, you know, for all the stuff we're talking about, like goalkeeper, it's down to Matt Turner or Zach Steffen.
See, we got that Sean John in your mind.
Yeah, right.
Weaseling it in.
For center back, I really think it's Chris Richards or Aaron Long. For striker, it could be any of like 6 different people.
Not locked is what we're saying here, folks. Not locked. I truly believe it's Jesus, and then they'll figure out who's behind him at this point. But some, you know, 6 months, big 6 months to come here. First World Cup game is set, as we told you, you know, at Wales, November 21st. Do we like the matchup for the U.S.? Put a bow on this USMNT conversation. We'll talk to Peter Galindo about the match that wasn't for Canada against Panama. Is that a good matchup for the U.S.? Is that the best outcome from the playoff? Man, probably you would want Scotland if you were going for the weakest opponent, so to speak. Sure, we'll get some, you know, some hate mail, some Boa Vista-esque hate mail from that one. But what do you think, Dave? Wales. Our utmost expert. It's Canada. It's Wales. It's David Goss's territory.
For sure. It's Boaz Myhill, by the way. That's the guy I was thinking of before. I think for the U.S., I think there's an interesting element of they're going to dominate the ball and get a chance to come out in the World Cup and like really dictate the game and get comfortable and get confident. and sort of play the soccer that Greg Berhalter works on. I think there's an element there that's really exciting. But I watched this Wales team and it scares me because we can play like crap. We can play well, but we're going to sit deep and we'll have the best player on the field. And that's what will be true. Literally what happened against Ukraine will be the case. Now it'll be different. Ukraine coming off that last game, obviously dealing with a ton of other stuff as well. But Gareth Bale hits a free kick. It's a dangerous moment. Gareth Bale had one or two other chances to double the lead. He'll be the best player on the field. He'll be the most dangerous player on the field. Daniel James is good in transition as well. It will be a tough matchup for the U.S. I think there'll be threat on the counter the whole time, but they'll get to dictate the game. They'll get to dictate the tempo of the game and the way they want to play. And I think that's pretty exciting in that, right? It was interesting just watching the game because you're thinking these two teams play opposite. And so the test for the U.S. for Ukraine to Wales would literally be polar opposites. And that's not what they have to deal with Wales.
What do you think Chad Ashton needs to do for the remainder of the MLS season to get the best out of Gareth and to get him prepared for the World Cup?
I assume Loudoun County probably has the courses around there, so it's probably an easy commute.
Oh no! If golf's what he's looking for, man, that part of the country is not a bad part of the country to go. Okay. So we had Andres.
You guys put in the rundown. Where would Gareth Bale fit best? And I spent actual time thinking about
that. Tell me where. Because Brahma Ghosh hit us up and said golf in Columbus is surprisingly good as well. Columbus, you got those DP spots out there. I don't know if Gareth Bale
would go to. If you're making that argument, I feel like you got to go to Colorado because you can just smack a ball. And Keegan Rosenberry's there as well.
That's a good point. So, you don't even have to do anything. You gain like 30 yards distance off the tee.
Yeah, but Kalen, do you really think Gareth Bale's an upgrade over Michael Barrios? Does he change that game for the Colorado Rapids?
Now that Shinyashiki left, I think
let's talk final
there.
Product with Jonathan Lewis in here. Let's compare and contrast.
Oh, boy.
Is Gareth Bale better than Fabian Herbers for Chicago? Will he change the game?
Okay, I don't know that. You've been pretty high on Chris Mueller, so that's a real competition. Yeah, you're pretty high on him there. Anders said that the U.S. should basically retire from international soccer if they don't get 6 points against Iran and Wales. What do we think about – are the U.S. MNT favorites to get out of the group with England? You can give me as little,
but these teams are good. Like the U.S. could very easily walk out of Qatar with 0 points. They're going to have to play really well to beat Iran and Wales. Like these teams are. Go ahead.
Didn't Iran draw Portugal and Spain at the last World Cup?
No.
They drew Portugal 100%. I don't know. Maybe they lost 2-1 to Spain in the end. And then Wales went to what?
I was thinking of Argentina. That was 2014 when they played Argentina.
Yeah, they got smoked. Yeah. They were in that group with Morocco last time.
Okay. Go ahead.
And then Wales went to what? The Euro semifinal? Quarterfinal at the last tournament? My point being, to what Doyle said, these are good teams. It's a tournament. This is a tough setup. I don't buy into the, like, fold the team, demand this. But the U.S. is in a place, in a group that they can qualify out of. And I think it's fair to set the expectation that they should. I don't really then care what the points look like or the results in what order to get out of it. I think it's right to say that the 2022 World Cup expectations that the U.S. gets to the round of 16.
So Iran at the last World Cup, 1-0 winner, 90 plus 5 against Morocco was an own goal.
I was at that game. Amazing.
They lost 1-0 to Spain. Diego Costa with the single goal there. And then it was a 1-1 against Portugal. A 90-plus-3 penalty for Iran to draw that game.
And it was a completely different tournament, by the way. Iran played Carlos Queiroz, 10 behind the ball, tried to score on set pieces. They are an open team now. They've got forwards playing for Porto and Bayer Leverkusen. They're playing at a different level in different soccer. My point being, though, is like, let's not be, oh, it's Iran. They only play teams in Asia. No one cares. This, you know, all we do is watch Chelsea and then dunk on Liverpool. Like, let's just make sure we remember all of that.
Nice. All right, let's. That's it for our USMNT combo. If you have thoughts, hit us up 412-060-MLS. The best way probably these days is to get us on Twitter at Extra Time. Just so you know, all the reporting, all the news out of this camp, again, as we've said, is that the two friendlies in the September window will be against opponents from AFC, and they will be, quote, World Cup participants, according to Greg Berhalter. So, Iran won't be Iran. They're already in the group. Australia is in a playoff, so it won't be Australia. Qatar, South Korea, Japan, Saudi Arabia would be the four that you would think those would come from. So we'll see what that is. Let's have a chat here with Peter Galindo, who you know from Sportsnet and MLS as well. Canada was going to play. We were prepared to do a watch-along, which is the least important thing among all of the news there. But it didn't happen. Players went on strike a couple days before, did not train, and then they did not play against Panama. Put out a statement. There is an issue at play with compensation from the World Cup and, the CSA overall, the funding, some of the business agreements there. Let's have a chat with Peter. All right, it's an AT&T 5G call to the field. Over to BC we go to talk about Canada and the game that they didn't play and the ongoing negotiations, I guess you would call them, between the players and the CSA. Peter Galindo with us from Sportsnet and, of course, MLS Soccer. Peter, what's up, man? This is an interesting time in Canadian soccer.
Very much so, and I have barely slept a wink over the last couple of days, but you know what? It's been busy, at least, so I can't complain about that.
So let's go big picture. Let's take it like as wide as we possibly can to help people understand maybe the history of what's behind this as well as what has actually happened in the last, I don't know, week or so. Take us through it, man.
Yeah, I'll do my best here. So essentially, when the Canadian men's national team qualified for the World Cup, negotiations began in terms of how the FIFA windfalls would be split between the federation and the players. And apparently, there was very little progress made up until maybe about a week or two ago in this regard, but not enough for the players to be satisfied, which led to them not showing up to training on Friday, not showing up to training on Saturday, by which point reports started to trickle out that they were protesting the pay dispute. They were taking a stand. Some were wondering if they chose this specific time in light of the Iran friendly getting canceled, the fact that they had to hastily schedule the Panama friendly, which, as we now know, eventually got canceled, and we're maybe trying to capitalize on the situation. But that is how we have kind of gotten to this point, in that we're now wondering if this is going to trickle into Nations League, which would then bring in potentially CONCACAF as well as FIFA involvement.
What is the issue for the Canadian players?
They feel that the federation is taking a bigger slice of the pie than maybe they deserve. The players essentially just want more of that money. They also want greater transparency regarding the broadcast rights, which, yes, are partially owned by Canada Soccer, but it was levied by what is essentially the Soccer United marketing equivalent of Canada in Canadian soccer business. And there is really no clear outline in terms of whether, you know, how the money is split, how much money is given to Canada Soccer, and how much goes to Canadian soccer business, which in a way is a separate entity, as it is the marketing arm of the Canadian Premier League, the tier one domestic league in Canada. And the players essentially just want to know, hey, when we negotiate future deals, like say for the 2026 cycle, when we get paid for qualifying matches and all this, are we going to have that broadcasting rights pool of money to be able to get deals that are similar in a way, at least structurally the same, as how the U.S. men are paid? Now, not the same figures, but it's organized in the same way. And so the players want to get some clarity regarding how is that money divvied up? How much can we be entitled to? And how does that impact us in the future? So that's a second one. The third one is, due to new Canadian labor laws, as well as, I believe, FIFA laws, and in light of what happened with the U.S. soccer men's and women's dispute when it came to equal pay, they want the women involved in on this as well, in terms of getting their fair share, their equal share of the World Cup prize money. And then in the future to basically split revenues evenly. Now, the women came out and said that they hadn't really spoken to the men about this. So there's some discrepancies in terms of, you know, what the men are saying is going to happen, or in terms of what they want to happen on behalf of the women, and then what the women actually want. So there are many different issues here, but those are the three or four big ones.
When you look at, I guess you mentioned sort of the timing of the conversations last week. I think that's been a big reaction for people. One is, why is this, what was happening a month ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 6 months ago that this wasn't dealt with? And are they out of a CBA? Because I have not heard that part yet. Like, understood that the World Cup is coming up and that's an opportunity. Is that just the players looking at this and saying, this is now what we want because we qualified?
Well, see, that's the interesting part, because this broadcast rights deal was agreed to in 2018, possibly 2019. And the players in their letter, in terms of listing their demands, had said that they only just learned about the nature of this broadcast rights deal. So that says to me that when they were negotiating this, in terms of just, even if it was just the World Cup prize money, in terms of how much they wanted to get, when they were maybe looking ahead and they were thinking to themselves, well, how much revenue is Canada Soccer generating? How much money could they actually afford to give us? Because they might be saying, hey, this windfall is going to help all areas of the federation, including you guys. Could you maybe give up a little more of your share to be able to help everybody? They might think, well, where is the revenue coming from? Oh, broadcast rights, I'm sure, is part of that. Oh, but wait, Canadian Soccer Business might be taking a cut of this and therefore hurting us. So I think they maybe only just found out about this as they were negotiating, because, I mean, as I said, they've been talking for 2.5, almost 3 months now, and this is now only just coming to light. And I feel like they maybe became privy to this possibly a week or so ago, just based on the timelines of how this has sort of worked out over the last couple of days.
Seems like champagne problems in a way, in the sense that these are not issues that Canadian soccer players have had to deal with in a number of decades.
Right.
What is the, like, it seems to me that this group of players would have unprecedented sort of, you know, profile and leverage and ability to shape deals and the future of Canadian soccer like this. So how does that profile work in terms of the Canadian public? And then what is the state of negotiations like today? Because as you said, they got a match coming up. Like, they're supposed to play Curaçao. Mm. It's in the Nations League. It's not the same as a friendly organized by the CSA. There are sanctioning bodies for this. It's an official competition. So what is sort of the game of chicken that these players are playing? And do you think it could apply to these Nation League matches, or will it get resolved?
Well, that's certainly the big question. In terms of how, you know, the first question you asked there, Weeby, the fans are, I think for the most part, they're on the players' side here. I don't think that after the cancellation, it's ruined a lot of the goodwill, but there are certainly some people, mainly in Vancouver, who were looking forward to getting to watch the men's national team play for the first time in 3 years, who are a little peeved by this. And they think that the players are maybe being a little selfish in that regard and not thinking about the fans. And I can understand both points of view, to be honest. Now, in terms of, you know, whether this is going to get done, how long this could last for, this is why I feel like they're now expediting this entire process, because now the women are actually speaking to the federation to try and work out the equity and basically their share of this pie. And that might actually help push things along a little more, as well as the fact that John Herdman apparently is stuck in the middle of these, of both sides, really, because he has to be loyal to his players, of course, but then he also has an employer that he has to tend to as well. So I feel like both of those factors could expedite this, but if this trickles into Thursday, that is when, as you mentioned, this is when CONCACAF and FIFA could get involved in terms of sanctioning, because up until now with Iran and Panama, it's just federation to federation working out damages. But this could be far more detrimental if it trickles into the Nations League.
Let's talk a little bit about the federation. Obviously, CSA is now under this microscope. Weeby mentioned champagne problems for the players. for the Federation as well, right? They didn't have probably in their plan in 2018, well, we will win CONCACAF World Cup qualifying and go to the 2022 World Cup. The women will win a gold medal at the Olympics. Hopeful, but probably not there. Now you're talking about Federation. Just talk to us a little bit about this organization, the power players, the size of them, the way they operate. It hasn't been a good month and a half with the Iran game and now to this. And I think all of us are sort of starting to learn who the CSA is.
Exactly. And this is the thing. A lot of us who've covered this program for a long time are used to this. But now that they're in the public eye in Canada a lot more, all these issues are now just like basically their dirty laundry is being aired now in front of everybody, as opposed to just a small group of people. So that really... this is really where you start to see that the CSA is a very small organization, at least in comparison to US soccer, in terms of FMF in Mexico, pretty much any federation that is going to the World Cup, they are quite small in comparison. They operate with a $25 million budget as of 2021, I believe. They get about $4 million in government funding, which accounts for something around 15% of their funds that they bring in. And then the vast majority of it is through commercial, through sponsorships. And then as they list other fees, which I would imagine includes broadcasting and all that. But that is how it essentially works out. And then because they have the men to look after, the women to look after, they got their para teams, the beach soccer teams, they got to cover grassroots and everything else. And this is where the CSA is kind of coming from. They're like, listen, even if we only had the men and the women to essentially manage, the deal the players are asking for is untenable. Those were the words of President Nick Bontis yesterday. And that is really what the situation is for the CSA, in that they are kind of coming from this from the point of view of, we don't really have a lot of money to play with here. This $10 million, possibly upwards of 15 in terms of what John Herdman said a few months ago, this could be transformative for soccer in Canada. So can you please give up a little bit more now in the hopes of maybe getting more later? And then I think maybe this is what's really led to this all blowing up, in that this is not only going to affect what's, you know, the money that's coming in a few months, this might also affect the next deals that are going to come in the 2026 cycle.
Meanwhile, the players, it seems like, are saying, we're not sure where that money would go. You need to show us a little bit more.
Correct.
Is that a good summation?
Pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. MLSsoccer.com. Peter's got a great write-up of what to make of all this. If you want sort of the nitty-gritty details on it, and it's easier, I think, to understand when you read it and have those words in front of you sometimes, than in the, you know, throes of a conversation. I'll end it on a competitive side. Is there a price being paid as far as World Cup prep here, or do you think that's negligible?
There has to be a price to be paid for sure, because if you look at even just Canada's other CONCACAF rivals, Mexico had 5 games, I believe it was, in this window. The U.S. have 4. You know, they're getting in some very good preparations here against some good opponents. Canada... say what you will about the geopolitical situation with Iran and whatnot, and not having any diplomatic relations between the two countries, Iran was going to the World Cup. They are a good side. They would have been a very good test for Canada. You lose that. You reschedule a friendly against a familiar opponent in Panama. Say what you will about the quality of the opponent, it's still a game to help you prepare. Now you're left with potentially 2 Nations League games. And if this trickles any further, you might even have less than that. And then you only have the September window after this. The plan is to go to Europe and play friendlies there to deal with the World Cup in November. So you're losing very valuable time here, and not even just games as well, but training sessions. Because prior to Friday's canceled session, Canada had 16 sessions left between now and Qatar. They're now down to 14, possibly now 13, because I guess they maybe wouldn't have trained today had they played, but it could go down to 13 by tomorrow. And then you're losing even more time on the training ground, which can be just as beneficial. So undoubtedly, this is hindering their World Cup preparations. And that's why I feel like they might get into the room knowing that there's potential sanctions looming from CONCACAF and FIFA, plus the fact that they're losing valuable time to prepare for the World Cup, and maybe at least they get onto the field, make a little bit of progress, even if they don't get a deal done, and just kind of go back to business as usual and then work something out eventually.
Trying times for Canadian soccer right now, trying to find a resolution. At Galindo PW on Twitter, if you want to follow Peter, of course, go to MLSsoccer.com for his write-up. Peter, thanks for doing your darndest to help us understand what the heck's going on. All right, a lot to unpack there, and they're currently doing so north of the border in Canada, trying to figure out the path forward. Yeah, Peter Galindo, one to follow. A lot of other good voices out there that are covering this. Joshua Cloke is one. You talked on MLS Today.
Rudy Schuler.
About this. Yeah, to Rudy Schuler. That was a great interview. Learned a lot from that as well. So we'll keep monitoring it. Let's go to Canada. Vancouver Whitecaps played. It was the random MLS game of the weekend. Vancouver RSL. 2-1 Vancouver. Vancouver now just a point below the playoff line. Andiamo. Let's go. Who picked him for the spoon? Anybody in this chat here? Kaylin's looking over his shoulder.
Sorry,
no, that buzzer's
buzzer.
Not going to ring for you. Buzzer's not going to ring for you.
Kaylin's like, right, packages.
Now. Yeah, exactly. Got lunch coming. Got lunch coming. I picked Inter-Miami, then they rattled off like 3 straight wins, Kaylin, so I guess we're sort of in the same boat. Bigger news, though, for RSL, Demir Krylock out for 3 months after back surgery. That's tough, Dave. That's not ideal.
No, he's their talisman. He's their MVP. And it was, I think... And obviously, we don't know what they've understood internally, so I could be wrong in saying this, but you worry that this was a team that was, okay, we're getting these results until these guys get back. What's the emotional reaction now to, oh, he's not coming back? And, like, us holding the boat together with tape is going to have to be the full season. Now, they've brought in Jefferson Savarino. Since he got injured, they're bringing in Diego Luna as well, who you're not going to put the full responsibility on his shoulders. Anderson Julio, I think, is finally healthy, and they've started to play Sergio Cordova in there. Not that I would say they've done it successfully, but he's finding his feet in this league. So there's options out there that, for example, they didn't have last year in the team, but this is a blow to what RSL can accomplish this year. And it probably puts in a different context the plan for the new ownership group. Demir Krylock's towards the end of his career now. Back surgery is not something that everyone comes back from. What are you using the DP spots? We had heard Cuellar for a while. I assume that was in a team that had Demir Krylock as an attacking piece and Savarino on the wings. Do you now have to use that DP piece on a number 10 or a second forward or a center forward? I think it changes that entire calculus as well.
Yeah, I think we talked to Dunny recently on the Power Ranking show, did we not, Doyle? And he sort of said that Demir was closing in on a return. So
yeah, this came out of the blue. To me, anyway, this came out of the blue.
Same. This feels like maybe there's an issue in that recovery that he was trying to push through and they thought he might, and it just didn't happen for him. But we wish the best of Demir Krylock, one of the best dudes in this league, one of the best players in this league as well. Anybody want to chime in on Kaylin, if Real Madrid offered you a contract – let's say you were like carpooling with Raul back in the day. I don't know, something like that. You'd want to go, right? The Gago Slonina's agent wants him to go. Seems like Gago Slonina wants to go. Jeff Carlisle says that the offer that Chicago made as a counteroffer to Real Madrid was ludicrous and talks are now stalled. This is some really good like transfer bingo going on right now. What do you think about Gago Slonina to Real Madrid?
Well, I actually have played with a Real Madrid player at the Fire before. His name was Christoph Kroll. He was a Polish international that grew up in the Real Madrid youth system, youth setup.
Six shades of Kaylin Carr. Like, how? Where can we get in the soccer world? We could get anywhere, man.
Yeah. I think this is... I guess the question is like, he's obviously not going to play at Madrid, right? So then it's like, where does he... What's like, does he stay with Chicago? Does he get loaned out somewhere else? Like, I know he's young, he's 18, right? But he's in a good position where he's playing first team football. Or first team soccer, excuse me. But if he goes, so I think that, you know, that's the big question. But yeah, for an 18-year-old, the idea Real Madrid mentions your name, or make a bid for you, you're going to want to go. But I think there's also hopefully some good people around him that are helping him make a choice to say, okay, well, that's cool, but like also what's the plan beyond this?
Any thoughts, guys? Seems like
everything I've heard is that, you know, if there is a sale, and it looks like there's going to be one this summer, whether it's to Real Madrid or Chelsea or any of the other dozen teams that have been mentioned, linked to him, it's going to be an 18-month loan on top of it. Now, that's not 100%. Obviously, things can change. But whatever happens this summer, I would be surprised if that was the end of his time in Chicago. I think that we'll see him here through the 2023 season. And I will say that whether it's Madrid or Chelsea, like Madrid and Chelsea are the two that I hear most often, and both those teams are sort of notorious for never giving young keepers who are in their system a clear pathway through their system. So it would be the first of most likely many, many loans for Gaga.
Rate on a 1 to 10 scale, Dave, Tati Castellanos to Leeds. How excited would that make you?
10.
Get Aronson and Tati.
Yeah.
God, MLS shills rejoice. And Jesse, God.
Yeah.
And Harrison, oh.
And I love Tati's game, and I just think if he goes to the right team in Europe, in the Premier League, whatever it is, I think he's going to have a really good career. I don't know that he's a golden boot winner or a star player that you build it all around, but the amount of positions he could play, the way he could fit, especially in that pressing setup, it would be really exciting. And it would add to, like, this is the other part for MLS, right? Is, okay, we've proven now that MLS developed players can succeed in Europe, and people are coming in and signing the next Kevin Paredes and the Gaga Solanina, and where does Cade Cowell go? And, you know, we're on that track. But the other half is this 22 under 22 initiative and young DPs. And can you be a pathway for South American players? And I think Tati can be the, you know, the flag bearer for a lot of what MLS is trying to create and help out a lot of other teams on top of NYCFC with the 18 other Brazilians and Argentines that are ready to break through. And this would be hype. And also, like, what's the... when Jesse does something well and then hugs Tati after the game, can New York Red Bull's Twitter handle tweet it out? Can NYCFC? Does it ruin everything? Does it make it better? Like, all of that will be so much fun.
Yeah,
much?
A little Patty Vieira. Jesse
add Brendan Aaronson in, too.
Oh,
and now
my
it's
God.
Like, we've got the whole Northeast. Someone get
this DC too much flag
like, yeah. Paredes, we get Paredes in the Premier League? Like, oh, my. Oh, it's just a.
Someone get DeJuan Jones to Leeds United. Get Kevin
okay, but
Paredes
is this Leeds
well.
United, like, link room transfer rumor link thing? Is this just like the new version of like some of the older stars? Are they linked with an MLS move? Yeah, and you're like, is this real? Is this not real?
No idea. I'm not in the business of trying to figure that out. I just enjoy talking about it. Before we get into the mailbag and a quick one, Cruz Medina, 15 years old. He's our 22 under 22 player of the weekend presented by Body Armor. Didn't play a game, but he signed for the Quakes. Hype us up, Dave. I know you're about it.
He's the best player in his class. I think across the country, definitely in MLS academies, you're looking at a guy who can play center mid, can play out on the wing, and just for a player of his age, sensing what's going on around the field, ability to manipulate the game without touching the ball with his movement, dragging players, and then clean touch, creative with his touch, can beat someone on the half turn, can beat someone standing them straight up, link up teammates. He's played as a 10, he's played as a wing, and broken games open from both positions that I've been to in person. I watched him last August, I think, win a U15, go to a U15 final, and then this year rip apart River Plate at a U17 level. So in less than a year, took a two-year jump and was still the best player on the field as he continues to grow and develop. I know he went and trained over at Bayern Munich, and they were really happy with him, but his family feels like San Jose is the right spot for him. I believe his dad is a coach, actually, in the San Francisco area. Sorry, now that I'm here. SF, as the locals would call it. And he's everything you want coming out of MLS academies now in the style of play. San Jose has an unbelievable, I'm going to call first class, of the new academy they're building and their new recruiting and their new connections. He is the point of the spear on that, and we're going to see a lot more of them come through. But we're talking about national team potential with this guy.
All right, let's finish it with this one. Let's do some rankings here. Outside back duos in the league, top five. Doyle, I'm throwing this to you. I know deep in your heart of hearts you were hoping to get it in an hour. So the speed of this and the analysis put in and the thought, it's all in your court, man. You could high press this. You could tiki taka around a little bit. Give me your top five.
I'm not going to do top five. I'll do by tiers. Come on, Weeby.
That's true. That's your brand. Yeah.
What about grades? Grades is last week. I think you rated the Uruguay as a B-plus team. So, yeah. Go ahead.
There you go. Yeah. I think the Revs, LAFC, the Union, before Andrew Gutman got hurt, I would have put Atlanta United up there as well. And it's not just duos. It's having a little bit of depth and the ability to change it around a little bit. But I those are the ones that jump out to me.
So right now, Union, Nathan Herrio, Kai Wagner, Revs, Brandon Bye, DeJuan Jones. By the way, Brandon Bye to Lille? Is that a...
Yeah, I saw that rumor too. I have no idea.
Yeah.
No idea.
Diego Palacios and I guess Ryan Hollingshead now for LAFC because Escobar is out, but a large TBD on that one.
Do you not include the guy who locked down Salah in AFCON semi and then the guy who captains El Salvador?
Say their names. Put their names out in the world.
Okay, yeah. I would probably put the Sounders in. I'm not the biggest Nuhu guy, but the Sounders, obviously fullback is not a spot of weakness for them.
Okay.
Next tier, probably. I'd throw Nashville into the next tier. Mwil and Lovitz.
Yeah, I think so.
I would toss in the Galaxy. I think Raheem's been really good this year. And Araujo.
Yeah, the Galaxy. Kalen, the Galaxy, I think on talent, might be like the best team in the league, but Araujo's really struggled this year, you know?
If they go to a five-man back line, is that a benefit for Julian Araujo?
I think so.
Except depending on who's playing next to him of the options they have. As a
Rapids fans,
it actually becomes more work for him.
Yeah, Rapids fans, don't get riled up. We got Rosenberry and Estevez here on this consideration list as well. Any thoughts that you have, hit us up, whether it's U.S. national team, MLS, or Canada. If you'd like to join my straw man army, please let me know. Always willing to draft you into the group that grows by the day. 401-206-0MLS, extratimeandmlssoccer.com, but probably best of all on Twitter, at Extra Time, every single show day, Mondays and Thursdays in the morning. I put out a tweet looking for your thoughts, your mail, your musings, whatever it might be, and then we insert them into the show. And whether you hear your name or not, which I will try to do more of in the future, it's always part of the consideration for the topics that we choose. Big thanks to Peter Galindo for joining us, and thanks to you guys. We will see you on Thursday. Adios.